All right, it is time for the after dinner speaker, and that is Katie Hughes. It is anyone who's been around this movement for a long time and is a different angle. It is Joe C. Hughes. Joe is currently the president and the CEO of Liberty Guard, a national government watchdog group whose mission is to protect and defend individual liberty. Before that, he served as the Iowa coordinator and the deputy campaign manager for Ron Paul's 2008 presidential campaign. Before that, he was the Libertarian Party executive director and chief operating officer, doing both Carla Howe and Robert Krause's jobs. One of those is enough in itself, much more to do. He is currently the co-chair of the Baltimore County American Prosperity, and he has also done some consulting work with companies such as Barclays, Mitsubishi, and Wells Fargo. Please welcome Joe Cheechus.
I think for the record, only Robert Krause can do Robert Krause's job. It's a Herculean task.
Yes, indeed.
And I must say that you're running great because you have Chairman Lark here, who is a great long-standing champion, not only of liberty, but also engaging students in educational prospect and knowledge of liberty, and I commend you for that. And Chairman Redpath is somewhere around the corner, and he is a great champion of ballot access and is really been a stalwart in that arena in this country. And I'm honored to be here with him. And Bob, thank you so much for inviting me. This is a true story. My sister-in-law is a clinical psychologist, and when I became the executive director of the Libertarian Party, she gave me coffee mugs. She knows that I like coffee, and she also suspected that I liked liberty. And so she gave me this coffee mug, and on it was the Bill of Rights, printed in very small print. Now, I put it in the dishwasher over the many years, and there's basically very little on it. You see the metaphors are coming, of course. And actually, the big word that you can read, it says, of war, and then state, comma, the, new line, shall not. That's about it. But it wasn't terribly long ago that I looked at it, and I noted on the bottom, it said, and I'll pass it around to prove all this, because it's from a group called the Unemployed Philosophers Guild. So my clinical psychologist sister-in-law gave this to me as the, I guess there's a message in there somewhere. The small print says, don't put in the dishwasher. And the Bill of Rights has been pretty well trashed. You know what I thought I'd do? I talked with Bob a little bit to try to think of the right things to discuss, and we thought maybe I'd share a few Ron Paul campaign 2008 war stories. Maybe that'd be of interest. But then I also thought, after that, if you're open to it, to talk about, you know, ways to really, in my mind, grow this group, grow the party, make the party, you know, stronger, better, bigger. And I just want to throw out one number that I'll come back to in a little bit. Just remember the number 400, just for fun. Remember that number 400. So be thinking also of some questions, because I'm more than happy to answer a lot of questions. I'm the co-chair of American for Prosperity. I'm involved in a lot of different groups, do a lot of consulting, a lot of work with the grassroots around the country the last so many years. So I'd love to help and share in any way I can. So a couple of vignettes, snippets in my mind of the Ron Paul campaign. Ted Snyder was the chairman, Lou Moore was the national campaign manager, and they called me very, very early on, and they had a handful of employees, and they said, we're going to be at BWI, come and meet us, and I did. And they said, we want you to run Iowa, be our Iowa chair, but you got to get on the next plane. And so I found myself pulling up to the Kansas City airport, renting a car, hitting Des Moines in June, about 10 o'clock at night. And I was met there by a volunteer, and he had a sheaf of Slim Jims. You all know what they are. Here's the reason why you like Ron Paul. And he said, we better get busy. So we were in the entertainment district of Des Moines, Court Street. It was pretty empty by 10, I must say. And he approached a man and a woman, a very large man, and they were arguing. So this was obviously a key prospect, a good way to get started. And he handed them a Slim Jim and said, let's get going for Ron Paul. If you know about Ron Paul. And the woman said, we have no idea who that is, and the man did not look like he wanted a second question. But the gentleman said, Ron Paul is about, let's audit the Fed. Well, at this point, the man, you know, got pretty nervous, and I started kind of standing back, and the volunteer kind of realized that maybe he was in over his head. And I think he tried to save himself by saying, let's talk about fractional reserve banking. And at that point, I backed off and I thought to myself in this desolate street, sweating, this is going to be, we have some work to do to get this thing going.
What happened after that?
Good question. I'm going to answer that. We actually, you know, really the conundrum was you start off with a sheet of paper and an empty street. And that was it. What do you do? Well, the answer is we got some good luck. And I think much of what happened in that campaign involved many, many wonderful people, but we had some good fortune as well, some good circumstances. One of the things that happened was they were having these national debates, these televised debates. We've had, 20 of them so far this cycle or whatever it's been. And they had one in Des Moines, and they invited everybody. And who were some of the names? Red Thompson? Tom Tancredo? Some big players. They had 9 or 10 of them, and they were all invited except Ron Paul. John McCain was there. And we sort of thought, what is up with that? Now, the truth of the matter was, in my humble opinion, that basically Ron Paul was the one non-intervention foreign policy guy who was going to say to John McCain, option B is we don't have this big war. He didn't get invited in. So what we did was, and it was an interesting little story, Ken, Lou, and I were on the phone, and we basically thought, one thing we can do is we can just walk away with our tail between our legs and say, gee whiz. The other thing we said is, and this was a lot of money for the campaign at that point, let's cut a $10,000 check, and we will rent a room next to where they're holding the national televising day. And that's what we did. And what we did is we rented the room literally on the other side of the wall of that debate. And the national media was there. And they had 900 people at that event. And we had well over 1,000, 1,100 people. Ron speaking, the level of enthusiasm, that was his first really big crowd that he had really had. And we really turned the corner from having hundreds of people to having now 1,000. And of course, obviously, his crowds have grown since that time. But that's really kind of was a big turning point where everybody in that room realized we were kind of on the map. And people hunkered down, and of course we had to do all the organizational building of the bases and organizing all that, getting ready for the straw poll, which was kind of the main event for Iowa at that point. After that was over, Ron called me back and asked me to be his deputy for the national campaign. And so I really became the chief operating officer. I was a business guy for the campaign. I did all the hiring and firing, hiring and all the finances. I was then put in charge of media and communications, which was interesting and challenging. And then I was a speaking service. So I had a whole lot of responsibilities. But our campaign headquarters were in Arlington, Virginia. And they were literally above a dry cleaner. And so one of the side benefits of working in a small, cramped space, like a rabbit warren, packed with people, was you got to catch these, I'm sure they were organic and natural fumes, wafting up in the laundry. I had an office. There were only a couple of us had an office. My office was, it had to have been a walk-in closet. It wasn't quite that big. It was able to fit one of those IKEA desks, if you know those little children's desks that have the ladder. And on top of the ladder is actually a little pump bed. And since this was very small, there was only about 18 inches. And so I remember, we would hire people. I hired about 75, 85 people in that room. And there was enough room to have two people and one other person. We were all kind of sitting and touching. And I remember hiring one person. I just said, look, you're hired with one caveat. Can you get on the plane now to Alaska, to Anchorage? And the answer was yes. And so that's kind of the feeling of campaign speech. You know, it's come on aboard and off you go to be tasked out. And I remember when the campaign, when I was asked to take the campaign to a 24/7 kind of footing, which actually does mean 24/7. And so I ended up kind of living in that little closet in that little child's desk, and it was this kind of acoustic tile, but it was really old, and I think they peppered it with just the right mix of asbestos, because what would happen is I would wake up in the middle of the night, and kind of bump up against this thing and had this dust come down that I'd breathe in, and that was very helpful, with a TV blaring right on the other side of the wall. But I'd get up and I'd look, and there would be a guy, maybe you know the name, Jeff Frazee. Jeff Frazee was working in the with the Students for Ron Paul, and that has become, as you know, Young Americans for Liberty. Not a bad group. Around the corner, we had the guy that was building out the database. It became the database that really allowed Campaign for Liberty to really have the kind of robust outreach that it had. Had that there. And one of the things that I did that I really enjoyed is I created a war room. And what that was is kind of along the James Carville media war room, where we had the wall plastered with television. And I said, our goal is to have Ron Paul's face on every, we had all the channels, on every single channel at the same time. And so what happened was, there was a day when, and it was the day that the campaign raised $6.2 million, which was, Hillary Clinton disputes that, and says I raised more, but I think it was pretty much the largest at the time single day fundraising. When indeed Ron's face was on three of the TVs at once, you know, Fox and CNN, and then 15 minutes later, it was on the next one. And that's when Wolf Blitzer called and said to, you know, that, hey, this campaign has arrived and it's kind of in another dimension or level of how it's going to be looked at. And since that time, of course, then we started getting dozens and later hundreds of media for a given day. So I could go on and on with lots and lots of war stories. One or two more quick ones, and then we can begin, if you'd like, some talk about how to grow and make things happen. But I remember, I remember as the ED at the LP years ago, I remember sitting in that office thinking, 10% of the people, this is, that's almost 10 years ago, 10% of the people know the libertarian word and they like it. 10% of people know the word, they don't like it. Maybe some people don't know it. And now it's a wonderful, wonderful thing where pretty much I've got 80% of people know what the word libertarian is and have a thought about it. I think it's a fantastic growth of our movement. Anyways, I'll spare you any more war stories unless you find it particularly interesting. But suffice to say, it was exciting. It was an exciting time. It was an exciting time to see these libertarian principles of non-intervention foreign policy and sound money and all the things you guys can recite in your sleep backwards being talked about on television, being talked about, considered, and respected. And, showing up at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and kind of going out from the kind of dais at the top of the library onto that common and seeing, 4,000 students have been waiting for about 2.5-3 hours, erupt into cheers, into cheering for hours. And to see that kind of vibrancy and excitement and know that this country very much wants the libertarian message and is ready to fund it, they're ready to work for it, they're ready to fight for it, they're ready to make it happen. And my goodness, this beautiful libertarian party has worked so hard, should be there and help, be a huge central part of that, and they are, and they have been. But I just sensed, I remember before the campaign, Ron Paul and I were talking, and he said, Joe, I'm thinking of running, and, what do you think? And, of course, it's easy to tell other people to spend a couple of years of their life and get stressed out of their mind. I said, sure, you should run, Ron. And he said, I'm concerned that I've been seeking the same message for 30 years, and it doesn't seem like anything's happened. And I said, kind of on an intuition, but I said, maybe the times have changed. Maybe it is a different climate, a different season. And obviously, I think time has worn that out. That the fact that people even know what the Federal Reserve is, we should all cheer.
Yeah.
We should all be thrilled. We don't quite know what fractional reserve banking is, but we'll be working the streets, I guess, all of us, to teach everybody what that is. Again, war stories, and happy to talk about that forever because it was a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I remember having the producer 60 Minutes sitting with him in my office, and I said, this is in the fall of 2007. I said, why are you even here? And he said, because this campaign has already changed the discussion for the political debate for the next generation. And at the time, I said, I have no idea what that means, and I'd like to leave it. But now it's true. I mean, think about what people talk about now. The word, the concept of not having a war entering people's minds, you know? I mean, we've been, you know, like lemmings, war A, B, and C, Bush, Obama, you can't wait to have a war. And now there's kind of a revival of this concept of non-intervention and so on. So it's been a wonderful progression that all of you have been part of, and many other groups and organizations have been part of, to really craft what I think is a golden opportunity for the libertarian worldview to really flourish. So, with that, I will go back to the... Yes, sir?
Let's assume for a moment that Ron Paul is not going to be sworn in as president next January 20th. Do you have any idea what his plans are? I mean, I know he's not running for U.S. House again, but I cannot really conceive of him just hanging it up. Do you have any idea what his plans are after this campaign, assuming he's not elected president?
I can tell you with total confidence, I haven't a clue.
Okay, two questions. Are you available as a manager, campaign manager? And number two, do you know any professional fundraisers?
Well, I don't know how to answer all that. I mean, there are definitely people who raise money.
I don't know him, unfortunately.
Well, that's something to think about how that would be, specific names. Maybe something we can talk about, because I'm sure there are people that can raise money. And the first thing about raising money is having a product.
Well,
you
know, we got people, a product.
We have a product. One. Yay, all right, great. Well, there you go. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, so the challenge to you, sir, is to be the product around which the money comes. You know, that it's not more complicated than that. You know, obviously you have to go through the mechanics and the knowledge and the science, kind of the science is doing the wrong word, but there's a methodology to fundraising, and you obviously have to have that and go through that and have the kind of startup capital to make that all happen. But at the end of the day, people give to something that they think is going to advance something that's here at that point.
I have a feeling we've got that going. This is one position in the campaign that we haven't. I've been looking at old contacts that I have where the email is no longer any good, and I'm still trying to come up with a professional, you know, paid fundraiser who knows how to talk through this kind of thing.
Let me just throw out. Did you want to make a comment?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to talk about that number 400. And you know what? Just for giggles indulging, I mean, the reason I threw that number out in my mind is I asked Bob Park, I mean, how many people came to the convention? And the answer was somewhere in the order, maybe 40 or so. I would say this. I have every confidence that if this group made a decision to have 10 times that number a year from now, you could have that number. You could have 400 people here. Now you have to go downstairs to Suarez and probably shut it down. But I think the market for what this party has is there. And I think it's a question of finding ways to take advantage of it. Again, I've been in the thick of it with Americans for Prosperity. I've been in the thick of it with Ron Paul. I've been in the thick of it with other groups. You know, there are ways and methodologies to grow, to raise the funds, to build the structure. And, you know, I would just say that I'll be happy to take any questions you like, but you know, the topic in my mind is how to grow this wonderful party. These people who, you know, have been dedicated to this for not 10 or 20, but 20, 25, and 30 years, and you know, have done the hard work of ballot access. My God, what a Herculean task! It is massively tough. I got to tell you. When poor old Newt Gingrich didn't get on the ballot in Virginia, I said, oh my, you had to get out there and get some people to sign some things, Newt. You had to get organized, you know. And I had the Libertarian Party get on there, and it's tough work, but it's able to be done. So I'll throw it open to you to see questions or your thoughts.
And I have discussed groups like Cato has an operating budget of $25 million a year. You have the Heartland Institute, MPP, Americans for Prosperity, and they're fundraising from the similar universe that we occupy. And it's 10, 20 times as much as the LP does, you know, $1.5 million a year. What are they doing that we are not?
Mm-hmm. Well, fair question. And some of that, you know, kind of like a stock mutual fund, they have what they call their benchmark, you know, and we're either a percent above or a percent below. Take Americans for Prosperity. The Koch brothers played a role in that. Got that started, what, 4 or 5 years ago. But as I understand, the Koch brothers played a role in getting the Libertarian Party started some 35 years ago. and I think the last time I checked, the AFP is about a $50 million operating budget. That's a pretty good number. Okay. Well, I'm, you know, now that you ask, Bob, I've got a few answers. You know, I'll give you the benefit of my thinking, and really more importantly, what I've seen and how I've seen people do this. You know, and some thoughts for you to consider. Because again, my own personal goal or my own personal desire is to see this group robust, big, powerful, central. I mean, let's be honest, if America needs something, it needs a third party that is for freedom and for liberty and fiscal sanity and a non-intervention foreign policy. And there is nothing else on the horizon, right? So I think if America wants to have that opportunity, it's probably going to come from this group. I'm sure you're doing plenty of this, but I'm fairly out there, active in the Maryland scene. And I would say, well, I'll give you one example. A couple of years ago in Hartford County, they were going to raise property taxes. And then I get a phone call and find myself an evening or so later in a room with about 10 people. And I'm looking at this group and I'm thinking, what do they have in common? Well, some of these people hasn't really been emailed with. And some of these people ran, you know, an AFP or a Campaign for Liberty or what have you. And basically the topic was, property taxes are about to go up and we're going to take to the streets and we're going to make sure that doesn't happen. And that was the only topic. And anyone who wanted to join this coalition, George Bushism of coalition of the willing, anybody who wanted to join could join. The only thing was is they were going to show up at a certain time and they were going to tell their list and they were going to bring out people and they were going to take to the streets. And what happened was you didn't have to commit to anything else. You didn't have to understand the Federal Reserve System. You didn't have to have a non-intervention foreign policy. You just had to say, in Hartford County, I don't want property taxes to go up, and I'm going to go after that county executive and that county council, and that county council in a big way. And it was an amazing thing, because it was just about the issue. And a few days later, they filled up that parking lot, if you know where they are. About 1,000 people showed up. They had people, they had a pickup truck, and in the back of it was a flatbed trailer filled with straw and microphones, and people got up and spoke. And there were, of course, rings with police officers. They're all very nervous when 1,000 citizens show up and want smaller government. And at the end of it, about half the people marched over into that county executive office. And they had a handful, of course, of the union kind of employees with little badges that said, support the budget. I kept one. Support the budget. Don't try to cut it. But 200 or 300 people went in there, and they stayed there till midnight, and they hammered it out, and they stopped it. And I thought, my God, there's no theory here. It's just stop it. Goddamn stakeholders tracks. And do things to scare them, like show up. Like show up in the street. Like show up with signs. Like show up in their offices and have a lot of people behind you. And go on the radio and be in the newspapers and scare the hell out of them, because they understand people showing up, and their side pays their union folks. Now we'll flash over to, if you remember, the big rally. Remember Ben Cardin's speech? 1,000, 3,000 people organized AFP, C4L, Freedom Works, put that together. 3,000 people. They brought out all the union, you know, folks that were there to create trouble. But they were so outnumbered, and Ben Cardin spoke, they were shocked. It was against Obamacare. It was shocking. they were really shocked because we gave them their own medicine. They're not used to this. They're used to us being pleasant or whatever we're doing. They're not used to people showing up. And, you know, again, many of you may have been there, but, you know, the march on Annapolis, 2,500 people showed up. And the speaking podium was underneath Marty O'Malley's bedroom, basically, in the governor's mansion. And I was one of the speakers, and it was really fun to say and to shout. You know, and I'm sure Marty was peeking behind the phone, and I said, you know, you're paid too damn much. I don't know, give back your pension. You know, it's fun to say that. But to have 3,000 people say, yeah, you know. And that's what they need to see. That's what they need to hear. Politicians are deathly afraid of people showing up. Dutch Ruppersberger knows us very well because we would put pickets outside of his office with cameras. I mean, media cameras. Things would change. Conversations, phone calls would be made. So I think the show up thing. And what I would say is that there's so many issues to get involved in. For example, issues that matter to people who are not libertarians. I mean, this is this whole treatise in my mind that we need to be looking outward. We need to be looking outside. You know, there's 40 people, there should be 400, there should be 4,000 in Maryland at this convention in a couple of years. Why not? Take something. Fight the gas tax. You're doing it. Fight it harder. People understand the gas tax. They don't understand the Federal Reserve, but they understand the gas tax. There's a whole list of things. You know, speed cameras, fight that, intrusion of privacy, you know, all the different things. I know that you guys in Maryland put together like a ballot access type of suit or some suit to do with. Congratulations on that.
No, we haven't gotten the final.
Well, you haven't gotten the final, but terrific that you're doing it. And I had just heard, and maybe you all know all about this, but there's a new law being introduced on petitioning. Bill, you might be interested in this. I guess one of the things that happened is, of course, now you have to sign your name. It's not Joe C. Husen, it's Joseph Robert C. Husen, right? You've got to be the third, right? And you've got to have it accurately, or it's not good, right? Apparently there's some software, there's some however it works, where they will go to the records, and they will get your exact information, and they'll kind of pre-print it on the form. I'm botching exactly how it works, but here's the idea. They'll actually get it for you. You need to sign next to it, just exactly as it is there, and then you and your wife can witness one another's signature. You send it in, and it's been very effective. Well, they just introduced in Maryland some piece of legislation, like the Patriot Act, or something like Let's Get Back to Traditional Petitioning Act, or something like that, which means we really want to be able to throw out, if you raise 10,000 signatures, we want to throw out 5,000 of them. All right. So that's the kind of thing that everyday people understand. There's something inherently unfair about that. Push back. Get in the news on that. Fight that. That's anathema to who this country is. In fact, now that you got me on my soapbox here, good God, this country's falling apart. You know, the level of propaganda, the level of loss of privacy, the level of loss of civil liberties. Guys, we're up against it. You got to get big. You got to get burly and strong and fight because nobody else is fighting. The Democrats are leading the way down to the pit, and the Republicans are talking a good game and they're doing nothing. Okay? So, I mean, I think we're all on the same page on that. Pop in with questions. I'll keep going on a few things. I mean, you know, I can tell war stories and this stuff forever. Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
No, please.
The problem with the showing up thing, you know, I keep getting these emails either from Americans for Prosperity or Campaign for Liberty or some maybe Cecil County Patriots that, you know, this rally in Annapolis, I got the email for that, all this other stuff. It's just like it's just so much. And I think, oh, my God, I'd like to go, but, you know, and then it's always a different issue each time. One day it's the gas tech, the other day, you know, like because of speed cameras or something else. If it's someone like I can't really even open the email anymore on something like that, how can I expect other people to really do too much?
The simple answer is, you know, many hands make light work. You and so many of the people in the room have been doing this wonderful work for a long time. Okay, and we all know, you know, it wears you down and there's so much you can do. We need new blood. We need more of us. you know. And, you know, Bob asked me to mention, I'm happy to. Two years ago, I was diagnosed with bone cancer. Fortunately, through the miracle of modern medicine, through pharmaceutical, that Mr. Obama thinks is cute and greedy, he wants to put him out of business. So, you know, I can drop dead. I really appreciate that. But I'm telling you that it changes your mind. You know, it's just one of those things. When you face death square on, as in I'm dying in a month, unless the medicine works. It changes your mind, and what it does is it makes you more intent and more focused and more prioritizing, and realize, you know, I got to find people to come in. You know, fortunately, my daughter is on fire for the libertarian, you know, movement. She goes insane to hear the stories about the war on drugs. She thinks it's just crazy, and she's pissed, and she wants to get in. She wants to be a lawyer. She wants to push back and fight. And you know what? We got to replace ourselves with, you know, people, the next generation. We've got to be building that, because all of us just can't keep pulling the oar forever. I think our job now is to transition from pulling the oar to bringing in more folks onto the boat. And not a few, hundreds of thousands. And so that's really what I think. And again, you know, when the gun's to your head and you're feeling the bullet coming right at you, it changes your worldview. It makes you get down. It makes you get down to the basics of what you stand for, what you're going to fight for, and how you're going to fight for it. You got to fight smart. And so I'm kind of in that process. And I, you know, all of us as lovers of liberty, we're all in that process of how do we fight effectively. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Earlier talked about, we basically here in Maryland have 50% of voters affiliate themselves with the Democratic Party, so it's very one-sided at the national, like 33% are Democratic and 26% Republican. So when you go through California, Maryland, New York, Massachusetts, they're so heavily Democratic, you're basically butt-head because the Republican Party is very ineffective to it, like Italian. And so how do you do it when you really had just a one-party system, so to speak, that, you know, anything they can do, anything to stay in power, and, you know, we don't have, say, an issue that really sets the state on fire, you know, you don't have a majority of population who want to make any change. They're so heavily entrenched, why change? We're either too much into the minority that we can't affect the change. It should, certain states we just simply say, you know, change is going to be extremely hard to go for the states where you possibly can make a change. You know, I mean, obviously, you can see the data, like how many governors that have been non-democratic in Maryland and Massachusetts, New York, and their House of Representatives, things like that, you know.
I'm a contrarian, and so here's what I think. I think Maryland is fertile ground, and I'll tell you why. Because it's so far one-sided, I'll give you an example. Sitting in my office in the Watergate, he did an LNC, along came the fellow, you'll remember his name, the fellow from Costa Rica, who is... Exactly. And there were other people he brought with him, and they, as I understand the story, they've done a wonderful job down there. And they're actual congressmen, they're actual legislators, they're actual senators. They actually have power, the libertarians down there. And as I understood it, I think the way that it worked is they had, say, four parties that were all the same. You know, they're all big government socialist parties. And so the news media would pick two of them, and they'd ask this party, and they'd say big government's the answer, and this party said tax more is the answer. All right? Well, along comes the Libertarian Party. And they have a totally different point of view, right? Smaller government. So the news media asks one of the four, because they're all the same answer, and they ask the Libertarian Party. And as I understand it, this gentleman I met him, he's a very good-looking guy, charismatic guy. I think he has a television show. I mean, he was obviously doing a whole lot of the other right things you have to do, in addition to having the right kind of worldview. But in due course, they began to win elections. And I'm not sure where they are in the last 2 years, but they did a marvelous job. Here's my point. when I speak to a group, and one of the things I was on is this whole issue of pensions, because in Maryland, it's one of the things in the central state, in my opinion. They just haven't funded the darn thing. It's too big, you know. And people would come up to me and say, quietly, we're government workers, and we're beneficiaries of this, but we agree it's got to change. How can we help? And by the way, we're Democrats. In this state, there are people who get it, who are Democrats. There are people who want to talk about civil liberties, who understand the privacy, who are pissed off about the new cameras, who will talk reasonably about pensions. Now, there's plenty of them that won't. I mean, they're literally kind of on the payroll, and they want to bleed the taxpayer to death, and they're happy to do it. But there are plenty of people who realize that if we don't fix the pension issue, it's going to go broke, and then there gets a lot less. So I guess what I'm saying is that everyone, Democrats, should be approached on issues that matter to them, independence, and then wherever we are with the Republicans. And I know it's tough, but what happens is you have to be building databases. You have to have an ongoing event. You have to be building the party, and it's an ongoing organization building process. I don't think I answered your question.
Well, I mean, you're usually camping outside the country, where I understand, but if, you know, there's no good, you know, like you as an example, I mean, you know, the Libertarian Party is trying to present itself as a third party. Then here comes a lot of Tea Party members. They get lots of publicity, paint, you know, followers, et cetera. We just don't seem to light a people's fire. Just say, here, take the Libertarian brand of politics and come join us. Some other groups, you know, I don't know how they did it, two punch lunch, but back then we had Tea Party, and boom, the whole thing closed. So, you know, things take off.
If I may speak quickly to the Regan situation, this is one thing that I'm pertaining to libertarian. The big difference, not a Rivera spoke to this,
okay.
He was the keynote speaker at the 2002 convention in Indianapolis.
Okay.
And they've got proportional representation.
I see. Okay.
They've got, the party was founded, and they have closed party list voting, which I would not recommend. I don't think that would make rule in the United States. That's what they use there, where people vote only. That means that voters vote only for a party. They do not vote for individual candidates for the national legislature. There are 7 provinces in Costa Rica. They have 57 seats in the national legislature, whatever it's called. And those seats are allocated. They are elected from each of the 7 provinces based on the relevant population. And I think there was one province that contains the nation's capital that got 20 of the 57 seats, and the other 6 it all added up to 57. Well, in any case, they people are appointed at the legislature based upon, for instance, they got basically 5% of the vote in the province that had 20 seats. So they got one of those 20 seats. So it was founded, Movimiento Libertario was founded in 1995. They hold elections every 4 years. The first one was February of 98. They got 1 seat. I believe they went from 1, 6, 6, 9. The last one, they held steady from 02 to 06. They did not gain, but then they gained 3 more seats in the 2010 election. So I believe the first election out of the gate, they got 1 seat. They went to 6. They held 6. They went up to 9. And now they have 9 to 57 seats in the next election.
Back when I was a reporter, one of the tricks, we used to get press releases from my name to the college newspaper at all. After that, the Libertarian Party, different thing. And a lot of times they didn't give you a story that said, oh, come be this candidate. You have to craft a story for the reporter, you have to frame it for that, get coverage. And it can be done. I mean, I'm working for Carl Pearson. I've gotten him, you know, not a ton of stuff, but I've gotten some appearances and got a big print article coming out. But it can be done. You have to relate it to the larger state or, you know, country. If it's a local paper, give them a local angle. Because if you just say, hey, no officials say, get away from me, I'm on deadline. But if you frame this for something that's in make them think, oh, there's a juicy story there. I want to write that. Relate it to their readership. Make the
readers well want to read it. You know, do the first part of their work for them. Give them the angle, as service and act as their guide to guide them through the process.
May I put you on the spot? I'll be nice. I'll be very nice. I had the pleasure of saying hello to you earlier. And you shared with me that you had recently joined the party. Welcome. A question for you. Are there other people out there like you?
I think so, yeah.
And what would it take, what would this party need to do to get more of you?
Well, I think you could ask the question about a state where it's basically one party. I think that's actually a good opportunity because as a former Republican, living in a state where the Republican Party is completely ineffective at balancing anything, having another option and people who seem to be more committed to the actual idea of that, it sort of creates an opportunity to be like, well, what has the Republicans done? And it's generally nothing. So for me, seeing that over the course of so many years and dedicating myself to the party that was not doing anything, that was a massive season goal for me stepping in and saying, well, even though we're not, you know, you might make progress slower, you're actually dedicated to making the progress that you're talking about. And I have a lot of friends in my life that I work with and I have who probably feel and talk in the same way. And I think in terms of social issues, it's a great way. I have friends that grab in based on the game and argument, they entrate them to a test. So I'm like, oh, wait a second, I guess I'm going to be a little bit going to actually fight for these rights. But feel like we're doing this in the same time. So I definitely think that just reaching out and exposing the opportunities among the party system sort of helping you believe in freedom in one respect and not the other. That's probably problematic. You don't believe the government should be taxing you like this, so why do you believe the government should be controlling theirs, controlling anything? But I think for young people, there's a huge issue.
What are some of the blogs, websites, publications? How do political parties or political information communicate with you before you became a libertarian? What were you reading and seeing that grabbed you?
Sure.
How did this party reach out to you, or did you connect with them?
Well, my husband is a longtime libertarian.
Ah,
yeah.
You got an insider. So I like it.
Yeah.
That must reveal to them.
So that was helpful. Obviously, he was, you know, criticized my inconsistent
views.
No, but honestly, having an argument with a libertarian, it was a totally different framework for me because I was used to arguing with people on the left, and
right.
I could argue for smaller government and less, you know, less tax, lower taxes, less government, less intervention. With a liberal was easy for me as a conservative, but then when I had to go the other way, I would find myself being like, well, don't you think the government should do that? And then stop myself and say, wait a minute. Now I'm sounding like the people I fight against. So it's sort of enlightening as I tried to argue a Republican standpoint with a libertarian, it started to chip away at, you know, and expose a lot of intellectual exchanges. So I think in terms of outside of my home, I don't know. A big one for me is actually Mary Johnson was it.
Great.
When he started campaigning, I came into contact with him a while ago. He introduced me to him, you know, over a year ago, and
Great.
I started following him, and I thought he's making so much sense. Nobody else out there saying this. People that I've supported in the past have not been saying this to him, and I understand that. But there's definitely a lot of people my age who you could get.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I'm just reflecting on is that, you know, in a way it's kind of easy for me to sit and say, geez, you know, doing a great job, but let's build and grow, and you think to yourself, geez, is Joe being critical? No, I'm not. I know what it is to just keep the doors open. You know what it is. Valid access is every couple of years. You got bills to pay. I mean, it's hard work to have a party. It's hard work just to have it. You know, and the other thing is you hear him say, oh, okay, rah-rah, let's build up, and then you think, more work than you could do. And I'm saying something different. Number one, I think it's fabulous what you've done. Number two, I'm advocating for you bringing in more people to help you with really what is eventually your legacy. You know, young people, take advantage of their energy, impart to them your wisdom.
Actually,
watch your breath,
not that gentleman.
Oh, yes, really wild, crazy thoughts.
Good. At
the moment, there's about, you never can tell me, Mike, turn out pretty good. Operation Homeless, done, met occupied.
Yeah, kind of combined them?
Well, just go and do one at.
Oh, definitely. I mean, if you say to me pretty much any idea that involves outreach, talking to people mm-hmm. who do not now identify themselves as a libertarian, I say do it. Mm-hmm. And a couple of them might be.
Yeah.
So what? The other 98 are going to be fabulous. Mm-hmm. The other 98 are going to be fabulous. Does the National LP go to CPAC now?
Yeah. No. Yes.
Good. You know, you find out. The other thing, I don't want to share this. I think it's so important for us, you know, and again, to stop viewing ourselves as outsiders. This is huge. This is huge. And I'll give you an example. In a town that I know, there's a wonderful individual who's a hardcore libertarian who ran for a city council seat and won. Yeah. That was the good news. The bad news was they never stopped viewing themselves as an outsider. And so they were part of a five-person council, which means they only needed to convince two other people, and they could get in the envelope they wanted to have. But they kept coming at this in this very adversarial way with the other four council persons who liked this person and who agreed with much of what they said. And as the mayor described it to me, this individual, you know, we wanted different building codes. You know, we wanted to take away some of these laws. We wanted to do some of these things this person wanted to do, but the person kept viewing us as the problem, not realizing they transitioned from being, you know, activist, angry, libertarian, trying to change the state to they were the state. And now they had to do a different process to actually have the laws happen. And so I think it's taken so much energy going back in the beginning to just get on the ballot, to just stay alive, that I think we've almost had to hunker down and view us as ourselves as outsiders. And with Ron Paul's campaign, I viewed us as outsiders relative to the Republican Party when Ron's a Republican. You know, and we can we talk to the Republican Central Committee people and all that? Well, you know, so I think viewing yourself as an insider or part of the bigger organization of people on these issues, gas tax and speed cameras, and participate in is a really big and good thing to do.
Just based on a number of things Michael was talking about, you just said about this kind of thing, it's very important not to prejudge. If you go out there prejudging, well, this is a Democrat, so he's not going to listen to anything I just said. Well, this guy's a church girl. Not going to listen to what I have to say. You're prejudging.
Right.
You're throwing a barrier before you even start. And you can even go farther with just what this guy was, which is, I can't believe they're doing
it. Right. I wouldn't want to belong to a club that
has me. That would have you.
Yes, sir.
First of all, Joe, thank you very much for a very nice presentation.
Mm-hmm.
One thing. From my perspective, I always like to try to get up on the mountain and see not only where we're going, but where we've been. And I think that Libertarian Party members are probably the hardest on themselves in terms of evaluating how much progress we've actually made.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the extent to which libertarian ideas are now taken seriously, of course, I actually, again, from an academic's perspective, I go back to 1947 at the foundation of the Mont-Pelerin Society. When basically Europe was still in ruins, you had expansionist Soviet communism, you had the start of the People's Revolution in China, which was to basically enslave a billion people. The ideas at the time were very hostile to markets, the idea of individual liberty combined with personal responsibility. If you come forward from that point, say on the intellectual battlefield, the progress we have made is nothing short of breathtaking. Our ideas are now essentially, we're fighting
not quite on par, but we are the principal contender for welfare state liberalism. And the people on the other side of the ideological fence, people like Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler, and that's why they write books like Nudge, using the notion of libertarian paternalism. That's why the English Marxists, who are amongst the nastiest bastards on the planet, they've been mugged by reality. They now talk about market socialism. Our ideas have actually made tremendous progress. With respect to the Libertarian Party, given the tremendous, indeed extraordinary restrictions that are placed upon my distinguished colleague, Mr. Redpath, is fond of pointing out many of those restrictions. By the way, a brief digression. I had the pleasure of addressing the Libertarian Party of New Zealand about 3 years ago in Wellington. And as we were discussing, one of the things that they found utterly extraordinary was the burdens that we faced with ballot access. They had no concept of how difficult it was just to get our candidates on the ballot. Given that we do not have lots of sugar daddies funding us, given that we are not a party of personality where we have a very wealthy person who's funding us, given that we are playing in a rigged game, and that we face a huge selection bias, and that is libertarians, by and large, don't like politics. We have actually made tremendous progress. The fact that we're still here, the fact that we are able to get ballot access in damn near 50 states, pretty close, the fact that we are running with a consistent message, the fact that more and more people who are intellectuals, and by intellectual I don't mean smart person, I mean transmission vector of ideas, more and more people are identifying as libertarians. And by the way, libertarian is an adjective as well as a noun. We think we're libertarians now. A lot more people are becoming libertarian adjective in the sense that they are agreeing with us on a lot of issues. Their perspective is moving more and more. We have actually seen a substantial change. One of our big problems is, because we're soldiers in